Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. It's been about 2 months since West Virginia was hit with historic flooding, and the struggle is far from over. Today, we'll hear a story of heartache.
He laid his head over on my shoulder, and I said something else to him. I don't know what it was, but he didn't answer me, and I knew then he had died.
And a story of resilience.
We are not going to be deterred. We are a resilient, tough people. And you know what? We're going to figure it out.
And we'll hear how Mennonites are stepping in to help by building wooden bridges designed to handle flooding.
Just about every one of these bridges is built within the 100-year floodplain. Just about every one of them is going to be overtopped with floodwaters once or twice a year.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today, we're doing things a little different. We recently produced a video for television and the web. The show was called Inside Appalachia, West Virginia's 1,000-year flood. It's about the historic flooding that hit the Mountain State in June of this year. In this episode of Inside Appalachia, we wanted to share those stories with you. We begin with the voices that we recorded in the days right after the flood on June 23rd.
And the houses were floating by. I mean, these huge houses were just floating by.
So when we tried to get out, White Sulphur was closed because the bridge there had flooded, so there was no possible way to get out. Scared. I was really scared.
I waded up to about my chin in water to get the dogs out. And the people were just, it was amazing. There were cats and trees. And it wasn't just me, it was the whole town.
I was actually able to call back in and tell my family because I could see it on the TV what was going on, and it helped them to get out.
I finally decided when it started to get dark, Lord, you have completely forgotten about me.
So I hollered at her and I said, hold on, the boat's coming, the boat's coming.
It took 40 years for me to build this and 40 minutes to lose it.
Total annihilation. The whole town is in shambles.
Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. It was called West Virginia's 1,000-year flood. The June 2016 flood that violently swept through southern West Virginia left destruction that you really have to see to believe. So we wanted to take this show and our cameras on the road. On this program, you'll see that when the floodwaters receded, yeah, it left destruction and despair, but there's so much more to the story. The muddy water revealed many resilient people and helped show the world what it means to be West Virginia strong. One of those individual stories of heroism is about Appalachian flood survivor John Wyatt. He helped rescue some of his neighbors from raging floodwaters in the middle of the night.
And sometime after dark, maybe 9:30, I walked down just across the road from where we're at here, near the City National Bank. And I began to hear the cries of the people in this area, down next to the park. And they were crying out, help us, God help us. And it wasn't just one or two, it was several. It's hard to distinguish, you know, in the darkness because all the lights were out and it was pitch dark. They just did it off the spur of the moment. It was just something that had to be done, and they did it, and they worked together. And that's what small communities do. It's what people of West Virginia do. We were able to, I think, rescue maybe 18 or 19 that night, and many of them, Mrs. Burns, I'm sure, would have been one of them that wouldn't have made it. I can see the aftermath of the flood. I can smell the stench in the air. I can see the piles of garbage that was piled up and the broken lives. But I can also see hope, and we'll get through this. We'll survive and come out on the other side stronger.
John captured the story of terror, struggle, and ultimately hope in this song he wrote.
Come and help us, come and help us. Came the cries out of the night. Many drowned
muddy water before the morning light. Greenbrier County, West Virginia, like the Prince Emmanuel's land, with your mountains and your rivers, here our fathers took their stand.
It's called the Flood of 1,000 Years because the amount of rain that fell in about an 18-hour period only happens once a millennium, according to the National Weather Service. Almost 8 inches in some places. The rain was a result of a vicious lineup of storms that came in simultaneously from the northeast and the southeast. Entire sections of towns like Richwood, Raynell, White Sulphur Springs, Clendenin, and Elkview were overtaken and large sections left underwater. Governor Earl Ray Tomlin declared a state of emergency in 44 of West Virginia's 55 counties. Federal disasters were declared in 12 counties. First responders were scrambling that evening, June 23rd, and into Friday morning, deploying rescue teams that fought to navigate their way into flooded communities. It was a challenge, to say the least, as many roadways were blocked, covered by water, or completely destroyed. 23 people died because of the flood. State officials estimate $50 million in road damage so far. The floodwaters ravaged businesses and communities. It destroyed 1,500 homes and damaged another 2,500. 35 schools were also damaged. Some of them will not reopen. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we're hearing stories from our recent TV episode of Inside Appalachia. For this next story, we return to Greenbrier County. I want to introduce you to another resident of Raynell, West Virginia. I met a woman of strength and courage in the face of adversity. As we remember her husband, one of the 23 people who died because of the flood, it's a story about a small-town Southern man.
They say country girls shall survive, so I'm being put to the test.
83-year-old Gerda Thompson has had her share of heartache. She says the home was flooded before, back in 2003.
Well, it wasn't nothing like this. I mean, it did a lot of damage, but all the carpets had to come up, and my kitchen had to be, I had to put in a new kitchen, and I had to buy some new furniture, but it was nothing like this.
The golden X framed in the picture window, accompanied by June 25th, just underneath, documents when the house was officially cleared by emergency officials, meaning no one else was inside. That's where Gerda's husband, Edward, took his last breath. Gerda remembers those last moments with her husband. The events unfolded from their bedroom earlier that day. Gerda and Edward watched the floodwaters rise to the road in front of their house, but then the water went down. She was tired, so she laid down in her bed with her husband.
And something inspired me to get up. One of God's angels had to be. And when I put my foot out on the side of the bed, the water was up past my ankle.
Gerda woke up her husband so he could get dressed. Then they began to walk through their home that was already beginning to flood.
I mean, it came so fast. By the time we got in here, it was almost up to my knees. We just walked from up the hall and from room to room till I just got so tired I couldn't walk no more. And we sat down on that, I don't know what it was, in front of that window. And he laid his head over on my shoulder. And I spoke a few words to him, and he answered. And I said, Dad, open your eyes. I want to see your eyes. And he opened his eyes. And he laid his head back down. And I said something else to him. I don't know what it was, but he didn't answer me. And I knew then he had died.
It was 11 days before the family could have memorial services for Edward because the funeral home in town was not accessible. The preacher at the Calvary Baptist Church of Meadow Bridge, Sebby Volpe, preached the funeral.
Just a classy Southern gentleman and well-dressed. I'm not a big suit wearer. As you can see, I'm known as the overall wearing preacher, but I wore a suit to his funeral because he was just a classy, well-dressed guy who loved Jesus.
Sebby works with a missionary group doing carpentry across the country and promised Gerda he, along with the Southern Baptist Convention, would take care of her home and rebuild. They're now working to restore Gerda's home, which is happening much more quickly than their neighbors.
All of our folks, all the folks at the Southern Baptist Command Post, are here because Jesus said, when you've done what you've done unto the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. And we're here to do it unto the Lord.
And while he feels for the family and for their loss, to him, his work has a larger purpose.
To God be the glory. We're just here being his hands and feet.
Inside, there's plenty of work to do. Gerda's son, Keith, shows us around.
Well, that bedroom and that bedroom did. It had hardwood floor.
Keith says almost everything inside the home is being restored. But as he walks into his parents' bedroom, he reflects on what can't be replaced.
You know, an 85-year-old man and an 83-year-old woman in 35, 40 inches of water for 6-7 hours. Cold water. I don't know. It's amazing, absolutely amazing, that on the 5th of July, I didn't bury them both.
Many items from his childhood home are at the dump or covered in mud, ruined by the floodwaters. The family's now left to treasure only the mental memories. And Gerda is all too familiar with just how precious those memories can be. Her husband, Edward, suffered from Alzheimer's for the last 6 years.
He didn't know me part of the time. He thought I was someone else. And I was someone taking care of him till his wife got back.
But like Preacher Zebby, as they call him, Gerda remembers her husband as a good man, husband and father, just as Keith remembers his dad.
Like Alan Jackson's song said something about, I was raised on the ways and gentle kindness of a small town Southern man. It's a pretty good feeling.
Gerda invited me back to her home to help cook a meal after the house is complete. I'm looking forward to it. While she was in the hospital, there was no question whether she would move back into her home in Raynell. Now there's a lot of strength and resilience. You know, there are 24 other families across southern West Virginia experiencing the same kind of loss.
Muddy waters, muddy waters, muddy waters flood our land. Children crying, people dying. Lord, please help us understand.
I've been here all my life, born and raised right here. Enough my kids. Ow. You know, I guess I'm lucky. I'm alive.
God's really taking you, buddy.
Yes.
Help your neighbor. Help your neighbor. Comes the mournful pleading cry. We are hurting. We are County, West Virginia, like the Prince Emmanuel's land, with your mountain and your river, hear our Father.
Come and help us, come and help us, came the cries out of the night. Many drowned in muddy waters before the morning light. Greenbrier County, West Virginia, like the Prince Emmanuel's land, with your mountains and your rivers, hear our fathers took their stand.
As the floodwaters rose and receded, there were an untold number of first responders, National Guardsmen, firemen, policemen, and of course, ordinary West Virginians, just doing what we do, running out to help each other. This next story is another act of heroism performed by ordinary West Virginians. It's the story I found in Richwood, also known as the Ramp Capital of the World, when I visited the day after the flood on June 24th. Like so many places across the state, the town of Richwood was left without water, electricity, and even phone lines. What once were treasured belongings are now piles of trash waiting for the dump while sitting in the driveway. Residents say water came gushing into the valley from the mountains, turning over fences and leaving a thick layer of mud on everything. The water carried debris through alleys and even rushed into the Nicholas County Nursing and Rehabilitation Center.
Probably within 15 minutes, it had climbed to the point that it was entering air conditioners. The sandbags were just no longer useful at that point. So then it became an organization effort of getting people lined up on hallways and making sure that they're ready to evacuate. And shortly after that, it reached points. If you can see the wood behind me, at one point, it was over top of that wooden fence there.
Alan Rose volunteered to help evacuate 97 residents from the nursing home, many of them in wheelchairs or immobile.
Well, many people were panicked about water. Some people spoke about childhood memories of floods of the past. Many people, the biggest complaint was, I can't swim. Yeah.
The nursing home evacuation happened before the National Guard arrived. J.D. Estep was one of the workers who helped with the evacuation.
I have never been more proud to be a Mountaineer or a citizen of West Virginia than I was in the middle of that disaster. People opened their yards, their homes. Wherever we could put residents, that's where they put them. They were out there helping us, getting them across the road, doing whatever we could do to get them out of that water. It was horrifying and incredible.
The nursing home is just one landmark in town that was saturated by rushing floodwaters on June 23rd. The Little League field that was just updated a couple of years ago was also underwater. Richwooders, as they call themselves, are no stranger to flooding. In 1954, a flood washed away cars, damaged homes, and businesses. They called it the Superflood.
I contacted Washington. Our wives kept breaking up so badly that I didn't know whether they were going to be able to help us or not, but they assured me that they would do what they can, and then our wire went off, and from then on it was just up to them.
Being able to communicate is something that many of us take for granted. The images from 1954 are similar to the June 2003 flood. But word spread much faster in 2016, thanks to the internet and social media. Former Councilman Jeremy Rose was quick to take a few pictures and post to his Facebook page. The pictures showed floodwaters blanketing the town of Richwood, even covering the high school football field. The town is still recovering from a flood that hit in 2003. It's rough to recover with limited resources.
I think most of the people here yearn to see this town not just fighting the current to keep its head above water, but we as a citizenry do not have control of our own economy. The largest employers are not anybody located in Richwood.
Estep says younger residents in Richwood were working to revitalize the community before the June 23rd flood, but says the process has been frustrating.
It is crushing, especially for young people in a town, a county, a state that is struggling to retain young people. Those that have got theirs and are where they like to be, it's not their problem. They're fine. We're struggling. We're struggling now even more than we ever have. But we're powerless to do anything about it.
And like so many other places in the state, the economy here was a challenge even before the flood. Still, Estep says there is a bond that comes with being a West Virginian that you just can't get anywhere else.
You can't buy that. You can have all the money in the world, and if your neighbors aren't going to help you, then you're literally up a creek.
While J.D. Estep is frustrated with how community leaders have dealt with development and recovery in the past, Richwood's mayor is determined to move forward.
We are not going to be deterred. We are going to embody the spirit of the people of West Virginia, the beautiful people of West Virginia. We are not going to be deterred. We're not going anywhere. We're staying here. We're going to figure it out one way and the other. And so are Logan, and so are Williamson. All these places. We are resilient, tough people. And you know what? We're going to figure it out.
Help us, neighbor, help us, neighbor. Come some mournful pleading cry. We are hurting, we are homeless. Oh, please don't pass us by.
You're inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On the other side of Greenbrier County, the Greenbrier Resort, also known as America's Resort, was significantly damaged, closed, and now reopened. Yeah, some folks have abandoned their homes and decided to move, but it's not hard to find folks determined to rebuild. Beth Voorhees traveled to a town just a few miles from Charleston, West Virginia's capital city, and found one woman devoted to, but at the same time very worried about, her hometown of Clendenin.
Heather Rausch, a wife, mother, and school teacher, is a great tour guide, if only the scenery wasn't so tragically incredible. Heather is matter of fact as she points out destroyed landmarks of local interest as we drive along the once cozy town of Clendenin.
Well, I'm taking you right downtown first. The highest the river has ever gotten before, I guess when they started doing records, was in 1888, and it was 32 feet. This time, it was 33.5, from what I understand. And it took out everything. Everything you see now was up to the roof in water. I had several friends here at Dave Knight's that apparently was in the second floor, thought they'd be okay, and were trying to figure out how they were going to get out of there, several neighbors. Dr. Schoonover's office was completely underwater. This is our local dentist. All of this was up to the roof. My friend, her auction house down here, this will give you some idea of how high the water was down here. It was about 2 feet above the banister on this house right here. That's where the water was. So every bit of this was submerged. As you can see, this is what our main street or downtown is, and we lost everything. A lot of it has been cleaned up, but all of these houses were completely up to the roofs, second floor into the roofs. This one was completely underwater, and there was a 99-year-old gentleman that lived there. Thank God he's out, but we lost our Dollar General. Of course, we lost our post office. Our library is right down there. And I hope they rebuild it, but I'm not sure if they will or not. They just renovated the theater for us. These buildings were owned by my friend Susan, and she lost everything there. My friend Becky owned a catering place here and served Sunday lunch every Sunday, and it was the best food you've ever ate. She is not rebuilding.
After our tour of Maywood Avenue, she takes us to the house of a good friend of hers and points out one business on the way.
Shane is rebuilding. I'm excited that Giovanni's is not going anywhere. He's determined to rebuild. And he's always so good to sponsor Little League teams and anything that goes on here in the town.
As we approach this neighborhood, workers with the letters DOC on their backs are picking up debris from a home. Inmates from the Department of Corrections.
And those guys have worked their hind ends off. I'm telling you, they've been here every day.
This is Marcia Naylor's house. A mother, grandmother, and lifelong resident of Clendenin, she took great pride in her once beautiful home.
We're in the kitchen, what used to be the kitchen. And this is what it is now. It's been gutted.
Give us a picture. Where was everything? Where was it?
Sink, countertops, stove, an oven, countertops. It was just everything's gone. Yeah, all the way around cabinets. They tore the wall down here. That was the dining area. It's just devastating.
Here we're shown the water line on a window. At about 5 feet high, it's as tall as Marcia. Pastor Ron Reeves has brought a crew from his church in Cambridge, Ohio. They're helping to take Marcia's house down to the studs. She's optimistic about renovating her home, but mourns the loss of some precious items, her stamp collection that her grandfather began, and her two sons' extensive collection of baseball cards, now strewn all over the floors and in the mud in her front yard. At his home in nearby Elk View, West Virginia House Speaker Tim Armstead got about 6.5 feet of water in his home. He says the flood that impacted so many has no doubt shaped policymakers' priorities when it comes to state resources.
Our resources right now are obviously going to be centered around getting people's lives back together, first of all. Making sure people have homes, making sure people are able to get back to work and get their lives back together and get our kids back in school. I mean, that's going to be a real challenge. So there are a lot of challenges that we face economically to move our state forward. But at the same time, I do think we need to always remember that one of the key purposes of government is public safety. That's one of our chief roles. That's one of the most important things that we do. I think that's one of the first steps is to try to get a real group that is always looking at ways to address flooding. The technology has changed since that time. The opportunities we have to get the word out have changed. Other opportunities perhaps to look at new technology that might be able to help us avoid the impact of floods. So Senate President Cole and I put this in as one of those subjects that we are going to be looking at through our interim process.
Back driving along Maywood Avenue, that's hopeful talk for Heather Rausch, who's worried whether her town will survive this.
And I don't want people to forget about everybody here, because I'm scared that's what's going to happen. And these people can't rebuild, not on their own, not without assistance. This is a poor town. Majority of it's elderly, too. I'm just scared of what's going to happen as far as, is there even going to be any life here after this is over with? Most people I've talked to says they're moving away, or they're not coming back. And this was a good town. But everybody's talking in past tense now, which really bothers me.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Beth Voorhees in Clendenin.
There is a long road to recovery. We know how to lace up our bootstraps, roll up our sleeves, and get to work. But at this magnitude, we can't do it alone. Homeowners across 12 counties say they still need volunteer support as they try to clean up their homes and rebuild. Thousands of volunteers have donated their time to help. Roxy Todd caught up with some AmeriCorps volunteers.
It's a scorching hot afternoon in Richwood in Nicholas County. AmeriCorps team members here, including Errol Rhodes, are suited up to inspect and clean the worst hit homes.
Mucking and gutting is when we go in the house and look for anything that's damaged from the flood, black mold, debris, just anything that needs to be removed throughout the house.
The team will go inside this home for about 15 minutes, inspecting the basement where there was the most water damage. They prepare spray cans full of Shockwave, a chemical solution that will kill any mold that's already growing and prevent it from coming back. Most of the 290 AmeriCorps are 18 to 24 years old. Some are native to the state, and some come from very far away. This team, all the way from California, has a unique story. It's a tribal AmeriCorps team, and most of its members are part of the Native American Hoopa Valley tribe. Chandra Norton says their reservation community is small, and everyone knows each other. Actually, she says it feels a lot like Richwood.
When we say we're from California, they get, they're really excited because we've traveled a long way. It took us 5 days worth of driving to come here. And then when we tell them that we're from a reservation, it just kind of adds to it, because then they just explain their heritage, you know, along with this. So we get to interact and know more about them, and they can know more about us at the same time in our program.
She volunteered specifically to come out to West Virginia because she wanted to travel and do something different, meet people from a different culture now while she's young. And she says she knows what it's like to lose your home, your possessions. In 2013, she and her family lost everything in a house fire.
Yeah, I kind of reflect back on that just because I can understand the position that they're in. I mean, I did lose everything, but they didn't, you know, and so it's I know that there's hope for them, and, you know, the building is going to be hard, but I know that they're going to get through it.
Volunteer groups in West Virginia anticipate that it will take flood victims as long as 5 years to rebuild their homes and their communities. Meanwhile, Chandra's team is heading back to California, where they'll continue their AmeriCorps service on the Hoopa Reservation. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Richwood.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Thanks for joining me for this special video edition of the show. You might be familiar with our weekly audio podcast. It's available on iTunes, Downcast, or at wvpublic.org. And like I've said before on the radio show, you can subscribe and listen on your own time.
We've explored the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places in a segment called What's in a Name? To honor the flood-ravaged neighborhoods we're visiting, we paused to find out how Richwood got its name. Here's a hint. They're called the Lumberjacks. While Roxy Todd was in Richwood, she stopped by the home of Millie Stinnett, a local historian, to hear how the town got its name.
Millie Stinnett is a retired banker, but her passion has always been digging up local history. She lives in the house that was passed down from her grandparents.
I was born and raised here in Richwood, as native as can be.
And what can you tell me about who the people of Richwood are, their history?
The history of people of Richwood, they're tough. They're independent.
Tough is right. Millie has been evacuated from her home 3 times because of floods. She tells me Richwooders have seen just about every type of extreme weather you could imagine.
We have had fires. Our business district was completely destroyed twice in fires. We've had a drought. We've had floods. We've had blizzards. We've had it all.
The worst was the flood of 1954, when the entire town was nearly washed away.
I don't know how to equate it with this flood. They both were bad. The only thing is the flood of 54, there was a loss of life, which to me makes it worse than anything, you know. But the flood of 54 is, we sit on the Cherry River. We are fed by North Fork and South Fork of Cherry River. And particularly in 54, there was like a cloudburst up North Fork, South Fork. Those two forks met and rushed into Richwood with a wall of water that had everything in the world in it. Trees, limbs, buildings. And when it hit, it made a horrible, horrible noise. And what it did, it came down through here. It not only, I mean, it devastated buildings. It took them down. It moved homes off of foundations. And we were completely cut off.
But she also remembers the glory days of Richwood. In high school, all the young people used to go to the Rainbow Grill after school to eat, or on Friday nights to hang out. Back in the 50s and 60s, the town was booming.
We had five big industries at one time that employed probably a couple thousand men. You could get a job here very, very easily. And of course, it's like the field of dreams. You build it and they will come. So people came. Employment. Employment was the key to everything. And logs and logging, lumber was king here. I mean, it was, everything was, you know, lumber.
And unsurprisingly, logs and lumber are where Richwood got its name. Before the lumber companies came in 1900, only about 24 people lived here.
First, I think it was called Cherry Tree Bottoms. And then when the lumber people came in, it was called Rich in Woods. And I think that sort of came from the fact everything came over Greenbrier Road through a very dense forest. It was rich in wood. And then when they got into the bottom and we became the city of Richwood, it was rich wood, one word.
Do you like the name?
Yes, I do. We are. We're rich in wood. You know, logging, lumber, those are our histories. And our mountains, people that have been born and raised in these mountains will not leave them. And those that leave always want to come back.
Still, the lack of employment has driven many residents away. And Millie worries that after the recent flood, not many of her neighbors will stay. Her home wasn't destroyed, but just about all the other houses along her street were. Still, she has hope. Hope that someone will help bring jobs here to Richwood, and that eventually people will move back. It's home, rich with many things, including memories. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Richwood.
If you know of another story about Richwood or ever heard of another town that you wondered how the heck did they come up with that name, then send us a tweet at In Appalachia and we might explore it Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly, you're Inside Appalachia. The floods that ravaged West Virginia in June wiped out hundreds of private bridges. Bridges that provide direct access to homes. And here's the thing, over 300 bridges were wiped out from flooding last year, too. Mennonites have stepped in to help by building wooden bridges designed to handle flooding. Flooding is almost a way of life in West Virginia. Since January of 2015, rising water has destroyed about 500 private bridges. And it usually falls to residents to rebuild, as Glennis Board found when she attended a special event in Lincoln County, West Virginia.
Okay, first we'd like to welcome everybody here to our another ribbon cutting. We came a long ways from last December when we did our first bridge. Mm-hmm.
So, that's Jenny Ganaway, West Virginia's chief disaster relief organizer. When hundreds of private bridges in the state were washed away by flooding last year, she set out to rebuild safer, stronger ones at no cost to residents, even though many people said that would be impossible.
When we heard you can't get this done, we made sure we got it done.
In remote and mountainous Lincoln County, Ganaway stands with residents, government, and religious leaders. They're on a wooden deck of a 50-foot-long bridge that Mennonites from Virginia designed and built. It crosses a stream connecting a state road to the house of Chuck and Carol Atkins. It's the 15th one they've completed.
All right, woo!
We've lived here probably about 36 years. And I had my bridge for about 35 years, and the water washed it out last July.
Chuck Atkins, or Preacher Chuck, as he's known, walks slowly with a cane.
I took it for granted to walk across there to leave my garbage, to get my mail. I have a way to get my groceries in. I took all that for granted until it was gone.
It's flooded several times around their home since last year. There was no disaster declarations, and that means there's no government funding to help rebuild. Replacing this bridge is a $20,000 job, something the retired couple cannot afford. Today, Preacher Chuck stands next to a sign he asked the Mennonite volunteers to paint. In large white letters, it reads, "Thank God." A few ridges over, probably less than a mile as the crow flies, but several twisting, turning miles by truck, there's a machine shop preparing steel pieces for the next bridge. Bill Fry is a machinist who lives and works here.
I do the machine work for the bridges. Yep. They have to take the bridges on site and then bolt the bridges together. Then there's anchors to be made. the pipe to be drove in for the pilings, just whatever they need.
Fry has piercing blue eyes. A lifetime of cutting and welding metal has left him with leather hands and strong like an ox.
And what other kind of work do you do out here?
Do for the coal mines.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Primarily you work for the coal mines?
For 40 years.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay. And how's business been?
Haven't delivered a job to the mines in 2 months. Not one job. Yep. This is all I've got right now. Yep.
Fry's handiwork ends up on the other side of the county with a group of Baptists. Jack Cobb and other volunteers stand on either side of a stream that has cut a 15-foot crevice between them.
That bank is weak there, so be careful where you folks are standing.
With so many damaged bridges in the state, other religious organizations like the American Baptist Men are now stepping up to help. Cobb and his crew are retired contracting and engineering professionals from West Virginia.
Midnight Disaster Services built the first 15. So they provided a coordinator for us to, you know, train us on how to do the first one.
A bulldozer clears the remnants of two washed out bridges next to the creek. Many of the bridges washed away were made of trailer frames and wooden planks or other recycled materials. Cobb says the bridges the Mennonites designed are altogether different.
They're phenomenally well designed. And what's fantastic about this is a model that's exportable with minor changes. This bridge can be 20 foot long, it can be 40 foot long.
The Mennonite who designed the bridges, Johann Zimmerman, says cost, as well as a volunteer-friendly building process, were important design factors. But the main challenge was how to make them resilient.
Just about every one of these bridges is built within the 100-year floodplain. Just about every one of them is going to be overtopped with floodwaters once or twice a year.
Wooden-decked steel beams are cemented to bedrock on either side of the creek, spanning across streams so as not to catch debris or disturb ecology. The structures are quickly built, more easily maintained, and more resilient than what they're replacing. Floodwaters like those that wrecked communities in June 2016 tested his design. All are still intact. But he says the most impressive feature of the new bridges is the collaboration between organizations to make each one a reality.
I have never seen anything like it before. To do a bridge across a stream usually takes a permitting process of 6 to 12 months. We've been able to cut that process down to about 4 weeks.
West Virginia volunteer organizations active in disaster, West Virginia VOAD, designed this bridge project. It's the first of its kind in the country. This year, it won a National Innovation Award. The Mennonite Disaster Service was an early partner. Other participating organizations include the West Virginia Department of Highways, local fire departments, the state's Department of Natural Resources, and the state's Department of Agriculture. Back on the bridge in Lincoln County, Barbara Chalfant is a Presbyterian who is also participating in the project.
When each one of us does a little bit, we can accomplish a lot. And the Mennonites have shown us the way, and the Seventh-day Adventists are coming in behind and doing an amazing job. And so the Presbyterians and the Methodists and the Baptists and the Unitarians and the Muslims and everybody else are going to have to come in behind and pick up the slack and get this thing done, right?
Hundreds more bridges still need to be replaced, costing thousands of volunteer hours and millions of dollars. But organizers in West Virginia, like Jenny Ganaway, aren't daunted.
We knew over a year ago that we had to do something because we had so many people without safe access and could not get to their home, and people were really hurting.
Ganaway printed an email she got about a year ago suggesting that this bridge project would be impossible. She says it's still taped to her wall, motivating her to press on. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Glynis Board in Williamson, West Virginia.
The West Virginia National Guard is also looking to help flood victims rebuild stronger. The state's governor, Earl Ray Tomlin, called on the Guard to lead long-term recovery efforts. As the agency looks to the future, they're trying to help residents and communities be better prepared for floods. Suzanne Higgins spoke with the Adjutant General to find out more about the plans.
On Thursday evening and into Friday morning, as we were understanding the magnitude of what we were facing, Jimmy Jeanette and I worked with the governor to develop five lines of effort that we thought would
As Chief Recovery Coordinator, Adjutant General Major General James Hoyer will handle logistics. He'll coordinate planning efforts among federal, state, and local agencies, communicating with nonprofits and volunteer groups. He's asking for considerable cooperation, and he's mindful that many residents continue to grieve.
Families are and people are still struggling. You can still see the shell shock in their face. So what we're trying to do collectively as a group and across the interagency and across various levels of government is to help bring, number one, a level of stability. And one of the governor's key focuses is we've got to try to do everything we can to bring these communities back to some level of stability and whole, as opposed to buyout programs that would just send West Virginians along their way to other places. Beyond the normal debris removal, now we're talking about 1,500 homes that have been destroyed, about 90 businesses that have been completely destroyed, identifying a program to remove those structures, to remove that debris, and then to leverage some unique capabilities that FEMA now has in their toolbox to allow for mitigation programs that allow people to build back in those areas but to the appropriate standards above the floodplain and to the new code standards to keep communities in some sense a whole.
Hoyer says this is an opportunity to build back better following the flood, smarter, leveraging federal, state, and local programs and tapping regional planning and development councils, thinking long term.
That means building above the floodplain. That means, in some cases, buyouts to create green space to avoid flooding in the future, and at the same time, we look at that with the individual housing piece. This is our opportunity as West Virginia to start to look at opportunities to diversify communities economically. So we've got to look at some other things, and we're going to be engaged in the universities and the colleges in the state and other experts to help us figure out, so what should Clendenin look like in the future? What should Richwood look like in the future? And pulling all those things together.
Getting residents to imagine the opportunities and then to stay and help rebuild are what Hoyer says will be his biggest challenges. But then he tells of a recent visit to Herbert Hoover High School in Clendenin. The school was destroyed in the flood, and it will take a couple years before a new one is built and open.
Mike Kelly, the principal of the high school, born and raised in the area, went to the high school. His dad worked there. We were telling Mike at the time that it looked like Herbert Hoover was substantially damaged and they were going to have to need a new school. And Mike's comment was, so what we've got to do is explain to the juniors and seniors and potentially the sophomores who will be in portable classrooms that when people look back at what their class accomplished in their particular year of graduation, that it was that they demonstrated the highest levels of leadership in the greatest times of adversity. The attitude that we're going to show leadership in adverse circumstances, that's a testament to who I think we are as West Virginians. And if we've got that attitude, then this won't only be about recovery operations, it'll be about recovery and reinventing ourselves for the future. And I think that attitude is evident across West Virginians, and I think that would be my particular group of heroes.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Suzanne Higgins in Charleston.
While we're no stranger to flooding, the storms that ravaged parts of West Virginia in the summer of 2016 were historic. The national media is gone, but the story is far from over, and the fight for these communities won't be easy. This disaster comes at a time when southern West Virginia is already struggling because of a declining coal industry. But you know, even in biblical times for Noah, the flood represented a new beginning. And like Major General Hoyer said, this may be the opportunity to reinvent ourselves. Remember, we are West Virginia strong.
Help us, neighbor, help us, neighbor. Come some mournful pleading cry. We are hurting, we are homeless. Oh, please don't pass us by.
Appalachia is part of America. We are, if Americans were watching this, not just West Virginians, I'd say, we are your brothers and sisters.
Emmanuel's land, with your mountain and your river, here our fathers took their stand.
And I know it seems like we're repeating ourselves with the rebuilding, but that's exactly what's going on here. And it might take some time, but that's what's going to happen.
If they love so dear, now their voices cry out to us.
But fortunately, we live in a place that's incredibly beautiful, with incredibly beautiful people in it. And I think it's time for us to be the new West Virginia that we're going to have to be.
Came the cries out of the night. Many drowned in muddy water before the morning light. Greenbrier County, West Virginia, like the Prince Emmanuel's land, with your mountain and your our fathers took their stand, and they stood for home and country, way of life they loved so dear. Now their voices cry out to us, time for standing now is here. Time for helping now is here. Time for praying now is here.
Music in today's show was provided by Andy Agnew Jr., Ben Townsend, and Corey Gray. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.